Just a trigger warning. Some of this reporting is graphic and disturbing. Please listen or watch with care. Welcome to 48 Hours Case by Case. I'm Erin Moriarty. There are now pages of newly released details in the case of singer-songwriter David Anthony Burke, better known by his stage name, David. The 21-year-old singer-songwriter is charged with the murder of 14-year-old Celeste Rivas Hernandez, whose mutilated remains were discovered in the front trunk of his impounded Tesla last September. David has pleaded not guilty. On Wednesday night, the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office shared a brief, and that's what this is, regarding preliminary hearing evidence. With me today to discuss it all is Los Angeles Times investigative crime writer Richard Winton. Richard, I want to give a little bit of background before we start, just for listeners to know a little bit more about David. I mean, it wasn't too long ago that David seemed to be on this path to major stardom. He had billions of streams on multiple platforms. He composed the music for Fortnite. And now he's in jail without bail. Tell me about the brief and how unusual that there is a brief without a preliminary hearing.
This is more a thing done before a trial in typically in Los Angeles County. Here, Deputy District Attorney Beth Silverman, one of our most experienced prosecutors, basically just laid out the whole case right there in a document in great detail. Basically set out everything they know.
And it was filled with some pretty hard-to-hear details. You can understand them, why the defense tried to get this sealed before any of us could read it.
Yeah, I mean, here's the basically, because you're literally laying out, how did David commit this murder?
In addition to the murder charge he faces, he's been charged with continuous sexual abuse of a child under the age of 14, unlawful mutilation of human remains, and then you have to add to that the special circumstances that exist, murder of a witness, murder for financial gain, and lying in wait. But let's start with, really from the beginning, what you learn in this brief. Again, it's according to the prosecution. It is it's their case. Tell me a little bit about her disappearances from home.
Okay, so we were at the LA Times, we were already aware that she'd run away at least three times from her home in Riverside County. She lives in an area called Lake Elsinore. It's considerable distance from LA, inland from LA. It turns out, as early as the age of 11, she'd had contact with David. Eventually, according to this document, by 13, she's in a relationship, a sexual relationship, and staying at his house. So at one point, the Riverside County Sheriffs have been contacted and her family have reported her missing. So they track down that she's possibly staying with this David. And they call him on his phone and he basically says that she's not there right now, but she saw her a few days ago. He tells that story. That very same day, Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies turn up at the home to do a welfare check, basically have the same conversation, emphasize that her age, that she's a minor, she's not even 14 at that stage. And basically, within days, she returns to Riverside County. But it's not over there. According to this document, he pays another student $1,000 to basically give her a phone so they can keep in contact.
What other kinds of information does this brief, does the prosecution say they found that indicated that he was, in fact, still seeing her and, according to this brief, having sexual relationships with her?
Well, they have visuals from his digital. They have text messages, numerous text messages, quite graphic and detailed. There's also references to abortion, Plan B medication, basically things which clearly indicate sexual activity.
According to the brief, the date, April 23rd, 2025, is a crucial date. Is there something that led up to that date? Is there a reason for that that is listed in the brief?
Yeah, so basically we get to see for the first time the most detailed account of what may be the motive. She's basically sending him texts which suggest she's, you know, unhappy with him, concerned basically about their relationship, and she's, you know, implying that she may tell some people about it. Obviously, that would have, as Beth Silverman lays out in the brief, that would have massive financial consequences if he was accused of having a sexual relationship with the minor. It would probably jeopardize everything he had. So what they say, on that night, after getting those that one of those messages, he gets her an Uber, and she takes it from Lake Elsinore to the Hollywood Hills home and arrives about 10:10. That's basically the last time anyone can account for her being alive.
And is that why the prosecutor picks that date as the date that there is no longer any more communications from her phone, but there apparently are communications from his phone?
He starts sending between 10:30 and 11:30 a series of texts about her not being there or not turning up, and in basically implying that she wasn't there, which is kind of strange given we know the prosecutors, as they have direct evidence, that that Uber dropped her off at the house that very night, 20 minutes before those messages started. So this is where the window starts, where suspicious activity.
I mean, I can't help it. I work for a show called 48 Hours that you hear those kind of details. And if in fact that is true, that he is calling knowing that she is gone, he would know that that's going to look very, very suspicious.
As most people accused of murder often do, they tend to not be thinking straight in the immediate moments.
Now, I do want to warn listeners and anyone watching this podcast at this moment that some of the details I'm going to ask you about are hard to listen to, because I think what matters now, according to the prosecution, they believe that she is dead on that evening.
They allege that he stabbed her, and more interestingly and sadly, they allege that he let her bleed out.
And they also allege that if there was stabbing, it didn't end with her death, that there was dismemberment afterwards. And was there a particular reason why?
Oh, okay. So this is one of the more incriminating facts, and I'll be interested to see how the defense handles this. Two of her fingers were cut off. One of her ring fingers. They allege that on that finger was a tattoo, and the name on that tattoo was David. I mean, everyone wondered when we'd initially heard that there was some fingers missing what the deal was. And now Beth Silverman seems to have laid out what she alleges the reason why they were gone.
And the evidence that they list, what kinds of things do they say he ordered in order to cover up the crime?
Well, there's the first thing that happens that night is they managed to track that his car and him drove all the way to Santa Barbara County to a remote roadside near a lake, Lake Kachuma, which is a long way, by the way, from his home. I mean, a long, long way. And by the morning, he'd gone back. But then he starts the series, or they allege, the series of purchases, which he uses aliases to do. The first purchase from Home Depot is a spade he has delivered by Postmates the day after prosecutors alleged she disappeared.
But it doesn't end there, does it? And what was the name he used?
Victoria Mendez. According to this document, that's when he took to Amazon and he bought two chainsaws, a burn box, a body bag, and a laundry bag, all in quick succession as the days unfolded.
I may be naive, but until I read this brief, that was the first time I even knew what a burn box, burn cage is.
Yes, but he did end up using another item, which would be not something you'd normally think about in disposing of a body. That was an inflatable pole, the kind of one that young toddlers and kids use.
How does the prosecution explain ordering an inflatable pool?
So what Beth Silverman has alleged in this document is that in the days that follow, in May, she alleges that David used one of those chainsaws to cut up Celeste in the garage in the pool. Blood was found in the garage. DNA tied to Celeste is found there. But here's a really, really, probably very important part of that. When they did eventually find her remains in his Tesla, months later, and she was cut up and she was in two bags, they also found embedded in amongst her remains bits of plastic. Plastic that the prosecutors allege is from that small pool.
Does that explain to you, Richard, then why there were those special circumstances alleged initially, the killing of a witness, murder for gain? Does that evidence kind of point to the reason why those special circumstances were added?
Yeah, I mean, basically, the whole thing is basically Beth Silverman is underlying this case with the bottom line is, in the end, it was all about money, all about making money in the music business, the success. In the end, she became a potential obstacle to all this. And then he decided to do the most horrific things.
Richard, I know the way this brief is written, the prosecution wants us to believe that it was absolutely David who did this. But up until I read this brief, there was a side of me that, I mean, I thought, couldn't he be set up? Do you really kill someone and leave that person in your car knowing it's going to be traced straight directly to you? Does that make you at least wonder about the details of this?
I mean, the defense is clearly going to present, okay, that's all you say, all this? Where's your witnesses? The people lived in this house. And what the brief doesn't say, and it's interesting because we had three periods of grand jury activity. An investigative grand jury sat in this case. They were different grand juries. And basically what Beth Silverman did was took witnesses in this case, people with information before that grand jury, and questioned them and then got the transcripts to help develop her case. She wasn't actually trying to indict him, but rather gather up information and basically bring people in who didn't want to maybe cooperate from his entourage. We know members of his entourage were sat before that grand jury. Parts of the record company management team was sat before that grand jury. So that does dangle that massive question is, well, where are they? Because then there's no witnesses in this document per se beyond the law enforcement and forensic officials. So there is this big, big unanswered question.
Richard, did it bother you at all? It just struck me, as you mentioned, there were a number of grand juries that were called, investigative grand juries. But isn't it more common that the DA would have a grand jury indict him rather than a prelim? And so I keep wondering, is the case as strong as they say it is when they obviously did not get a grand jury to indict him?
Yeah, this is a big difference, I think, that people don't really completely understand. So in Los Angeles, historically, grand jury indictments are generally rare. Other parts of the country, grand jury indictments are pretty common. Here, grand juries tend to be more investigative than indictive. We learned fairly early on that this was not really, they were not doing the indictment route. This was all about, hey, we need to get these people.
Richard, you had said that this brief really lays out a very detailed story the way the prosecution sees it. Now, before this was released, the defense had been very strong, saying that the evidence will show that that Burke did not do this. David Burke did not do this. Have they responded? Have they talked about this brief being released and had new comments about their client?
They haven't yet. What they did do in court is they tried to stop this from being made public because they'd obviously read it, were pretty startled by it, what had happened, and they tried to block it. They have not addressed it. What they had going into that hearing, they'd been pushing for a preliminary hearing as soon as possible, a very kind of unusual, let's see if we can catch the prosecution off guard. They don't expect us to go make this, have a hearing. In California, basically, unless you have an indictment, you basically have a small hearing with the judge with a limited number of witnesses, and they basically have to find that there's established some preponderance of the evidence. This isn't beyond the reasonable doubt with the jury. It's just, is the preponderance of the evidence that this allegation is at least strong enough to stand up to proceed to a trial. Here, the defense was like, okay, we don't think they're ready. We're going to go for it. And they immediately start going for it. The prosecution's like, oh, we're ready. But you should know there's like tons of terabytes, which is like the equivalent of like a small library, okay, to look at in this case. Most of it's obviously visual and audio, which takes up a lot of space. We get to yesterday, and this is the day where they're sort of meant to be setting the date. And lo and behold, Bev Silman drops this document. Not long after, the defense is now looking at, you know, next month, basically a month away from this date for the prelim. Obviously, they want more time now, but they've got to see a little bit. You know, it was kind of like, hey, you punch us, we punch you.
Well, but isn't there a risk for the prosecution as well? Because one of the reasons why you want a preliminary hearing is you want to surprise the defense with evidence they may not know you have, and they're not prepared. Doesn't this brief then give the defense a chance to defend this at the preliminary hearing?
Yeah, I mean, I think here the good thing for the defense, and it's probably partly apart from the fact they just got to look at a lot of evidence and they haven't got it all, and it's like an enormous amount of terabytes, is, yeah, they want to see the cards of the prosecutors here. They want to see what they got. Now, they showed some of their cards, let's be honest. They didn't show all their cards. They didn't tell us anything about the human witnesses beyond the authorities. They didn't tell us what the friends are going to say or who's going to. Now, they don't usually, in this kind of crime, put those kind of people on. Typically, they put on just the key detectives, some forensic people, just to prove something happened.
Richard, you actually alluded to this. The defense is correct, isn't it? When the lawyers say releasing something like this pre-trial really could affect the jury pool.
I mean, there's no doubt in the modern era as well. Affecting the jury pool is a big part of how things operate. Yeah, I don't think Beth Silman's naive. She knows by putting us all out there that even those who've never heard of David, and that's probably a lot of people over the age of 35, will now heard something about this, and it will permeate somehow into their sort of news cycle, their social media or something, which means she'll now have, you know, a leg up when it does eventually reach a trial, if it does.
Now, I'm just slightly over the age of 35, but I had been really curious about David, and I spent a lot of time looking at his videos. I mean, he was a person whose stardom was on the rise, and I was interested in how he had set up this chat. It was very large on the Discord server, this area called David's Closet. But Wire magazine wrote a really interesting article recently talking about how, I think the title actually is, they made David a star, now they want him convicted of murder. Have these young people who have been following him, supporting him, turned against him.
Some of them have, because some of them were very quick to start digging through the old imagery of that group. There's basically, you have this whole sort of interconnected community who put their sort of time into him. I mean, I don't know how this will play out at trial, but in one of his videos, he literally drags a body to the back of a car and puts it in there. It's actually very weird because he's also the body as well as the dragging
person.
Yeah,
it's him.
Yeah. And then there's, you know, another one of his videos, there's blood everywhere. Remember, they have like his entire iCloud. They have all his materials. So they'll know how he constructed songs. So he wrote some of these songs probably with other people. Typically, when you work for a label, they may have interacted. They may know if this particular song references her, or, you know, so this is songs which aren't published, possibly.
Richard, do you know for a fact where David met Celeste? Was it on Discord? Do you know?
No, and we just know it's online. His story is, I mean, he's an interesting character in that he developed his sort of early career just by basically originally doing other people's songs. He even like basically did this Alvin and the Chipmunk style voice. So he would find ways to expand his audience. And that turned out, here's an interview early on with Benny Blanco, a well-known music producer who's a good interviewer. And he asked him a lot of questions about how he grew his career. And he sort of outlines the whole expansion of basically doing other people's music. You know, he was in the sort of Fortnite game world where he became somewhat of a personality. And then he was like basically creating these Alvin and the Chipmunk songs. And then he moves into the real music and starts producing his own stuff.
I should point out that Epic Games, which publishes Fortnite, has actually offered refunds. And Rolling Stone is reporting that, in fact, he's been dropped from his label. Is that, in fact, the case?
Yes, he's been dropped from his label. We've confirmed that.
So we will continue to follow this case as it goes on. Is there anything else that you found significant about this in just one day?
I think one of the most, I mean, I think what we're going to see here is that the prosecution had Beth Silverman, one of their best prosecutors on this case. She's well known. She's done other cases of the highest level in Los Angeles and put away some of the most infamous murderers. But this here we're going to see two of the more power players of LA legal community play again head to head. He's been principally represented by Blair Burke. Blair Burke has had Harvey Weinstein. She's had numerous clients. These two only recently squared off in a murder case involving a very famous hairstyle executive. So these two know each other well, and they take no prisoners, both of them.
Are you predicting that the preliminary hearing, when in fact it's held in a month or longer, will be like a mini trial? It's going to get the same kind of attention because these two are going to fight it out.
Oh, yeah. This is going to be an early showdown to see what you've got. Of course, Beth could also, given we just seen what she did with this, she could also just impanel the grand jury next week and indict him and skip past the whole process.
Now, I don't know whether you got any sleep last night because you actually covered two hearings yesterday, two high-profile hearings. The first one was actually Nick Reiner's. Is that unusual that you would have two of these very high-profile hearings on the same day in the same courthouse?
Not in Los Angeles, unfortunately. The ninth floor is famous for handling high-profile cases. Most Americans probably only familiar with this floor, or maybe a brief reference in their minds of their to the history that this was the floor where Judge Lance Ito oversaw O.J. Simpson, and is kind of has an extra level of security. Luckily, my colleague James Quigley was also covering all this stuff, so he actually did the bulk of the lifting yesterday. But it's a microcosm because these big cases get sent to this one place in this massive LA court system, there's like this one floor where the judges handled the most biggest and most heinous cases tend to be there.
Now, this was simply a hearing, and I should, again, just for listeners and viewers, to remind people that Nick Reiner is accused of killing his parents on or around December 14th, 2025. He has pleaded not guilty. And I just kind of curious, what is the latest? Why was there a hearing?
What we have is pre-preliminary hearing, them trying to work out the logistics of how this is moving forward. Yesterday, we ran into a sort of significant obstacle, which is apparently the autopsy and the medical examiner's report isn't ready for either of the Reiners yet. So, which is kind of surprising because it was quite a while ago.
I know. What would be the holdup?
We don't know. So, obvious delay. It's obviously a major factor in any sort of prelim. It's okay, what happened? You know, what do you find? What forensically do you have? They don't have it. So delay happens here again. Now, we don't know a lot of details about the deaths beyond in terms of facts. Before that seal was put on, we know that the medical examiner in Los Angeles described this the deaths as basically sharp object penetration wounds. In the death certificate, it says knife. But there's not like a whole bunch of beyond that. We don't know a lot, factually.
I also wanted to talk about, unlike the David case, it seems like the defense is not in a hurry to get this case adjudicated. You have written about Nick Reiner's medical history. What part do you think that's going to play in this case if it actually goes to trial, or will it be the reason why it doesn't go to trial? Is there any indication at this point that there may be an affirmative defense, not guilty by reason of insanity, anything like that at this point?
We don't officially have that, but behind the scenes, it's being talked about widely because he has a history of mental illness, a severe history of drug usage. Prior to this, the deadly events, he's changed his medications in the weeks before. There's apparently been issues with the medication. All this stuff has been percolating. He has a very heavily documented history of drug and mental health issues. Some of it she's even discussed, you know, in podcasts and things, you know, quite openly. There's a lot of that. He's moved from being represented by a private attorney, Alan Jackson, that many listeners probably are familiar with, to being now represented by the public defender.
Do you know why? Was it because his siblings didn't want to pay for his defense? That's been out there. Do you know from your reporting whether that's true?
From our reporting, we know that we won't say his siblings, but we would say his family discontinued paying the law firm that Mr. Jackson works for. So there was a decision at some level within the family or the executor to no longer continue to pay. Will that affect how Nick's represented? I don't actually think it will, as this does lean towards some version of insanity defense or some sort of, you know, try to plead down to a second degree or something. The public defender here in this case is actually a very able individual who's handled that kind of case. And this case is very different from David. I don't think the defense will ever say he didn't do it. I think it's more he didn't do it or didn't knowingly do it. So it's going to be a very, very different case. And those cases tend to take a lot of time historically when I've seen them in Los Angeles.
That's a very good point because he's pleaded not guilty, but that can also be pleading not guilty by reason of insanity, which is saying I did it, but I didn't know I was doing anything wrong or knowingly killed somebody. So we will have to see that. How would you describe his demeanor in the court yesterday? Did he look differently? Did he?
Well, he's thinner. He's got a shaved, almost shaved head, very short haircut. He's, you know, he just looks like someone who's a little distant from everything.
Which brings us to Nick's older brother, Jake, who wrote a moving essay on Substack late last week about what it was like losing his parents. He recounted hearing about what happened from his sister, Romy, who first discovered their parents. I'd just like to get your reaction to it. It's heartbreaking to read. He wrote, "We lost more than half of our family that night in the most violent way imaginable. Sure, any loss of a parent is devastating, but nothing compares to losing both of them at the same time. And on the top of that, having your brother be at the center of it. It's almost too impossible to process. I understand that people have questions about what happened. Some of those answers will come in time, but some parts of this belong only to our family. And keeping them private is the only way to protect what little remains of something that was taken from us." What was your reaction when you read that?
My reaction overwhelmingly was there was something missing in the piece. He never said Nick, which is kind of startling when you know your brother's the accused here. He never mentioned him at all. So he said a lot of really dramatic and sad facts about the family and the loss, and he wrote beautifully about his parents and his sister's struggle, you know, dealing with it. But he never mentioned Nick directly by name, which was kind of telling about, it was like the unwritten what he was saying.
So he'll be back in court when?
So Nick will be back in court in September. It's just going to move on very slowly. At some point in probably the fall, we're probably going to see what the real plea is and the real kind of approach is. And then we'll see where it's going, whether this is actually looking at a trial or a bifurcated trial, you know, with two parts, essentially.
And I hope you'll be back with us to talk about these cases as they advance. Promise?
Yes, I'll be here. As always.
We'll be back next week with another episode of Case by Case. Be sure to rate and review and let us know which cases you are following and you want us to follow.